and it has cost us nothing. Why would this time be any different? Because this time you are being invited to act against them, Pied wanted to say, but did not. He knew the argument was over, and the matter settled. Kellen Elisadil was king of the elves, and the king had the final word on everything. Cousin, the other soothed, stepping over to put his arm about him, we have been friends a long time. I respect your opinion, which is why I asked you to come speak with me before I gave the command to proceed. I knew what you would say, but I wanted you to say it. I wanted you to question me, because frequently you are the only one who will. A king needs candid and reasoned advice from his advisers, and in most matters, no one gives better advice than you. He gave Pied a small squeeze with his powerful arm. That said, a king must listen to what his instincts tell him. He must not waver once his mind is made up. You know this. He waited for Pied's response, so it was necessary to give it. I know, my lord. I have made a commitment to turn the tide of this war once and for all, and now, at last, I have a way to do so. It would be cowardly of me to turn away a chance such as this merely because there are risks. It would be unforgivable. I know that as well. Will you still come with me when we fly into battle? The king stepped away, releasing his grip. I won't ask it of you if you feel strongly about not going, nor will I think less of you. Pied arched one eyebrow at his cousin. I am captain of the home guard, my lord. Where you go, I must go as well. That isn't open to debate. Don't make it seem as if it is. The king's intense, considering gaze locked on him. No, cousin. I guess it isn't. Not with someone as dedicated as you. And I wouldn't want it any other way. He paused. I'll give this matter several hours more thought before acting. I had planned a late afternoon strike in any case, so that we can come at them from out of the twilight, out of the shadows. You may keep watch for your scouts until then. If they return in time, bring me whatever news you think matters. I promise I will listen. But if none comes, I will see you on the plains an hour before dusk. Pied turned and started for the door. One thing more, the king called after him. Pied turned. I intend to take Kiris and Wensling with me. He must have seen the confusion in Pied's eyes. Aboard the flagship, cousin. I want them to watch. Pied stared. Kellen Elisadil was talking about his sons, about boys who were 15 and 13, about taking them into the heart of an engagement with a dangerous enemy. No, he said at once, before he could think better of it. The king seemed unruffled. They need to see what a battle is like, to understand what happens. They need to experience it for themselves, not just hear about it. They are future kings, and this is a part of their training. They are too young for this, my lord. There will be other times, safer times, when the risk is not so great. The risk is always great in war, cousin, the king said, brushing his arguments aside. Pied took a deep, steadying breath, picturing Arling's reaction once she found out what Kellen had done. With any elves in training, we expose them gradually to the dangers of war. We don't just throw them out on the battlefield, not unless we are desperate. We bring them along slowly. I think that is what is needed with Kiris and Wensling. Let them come on a few overflights first, ones in which combat is not a given. Kellen Elisadil took a long moment to study him, as if seeing something he hadn't seen before, something he was not altogether pleased about. Then he said softly, I will think about it, cousin. He motioned for Pied to go out, an odd gesture Pied had not seen before, but this was not the time for speculation. He departed quickly, happy to escape before Kellen could think of some further madness. Because he would, Pied knew. He was in that place where ideas came and went like silverfish, and each looked better than the one before. but never was. Outside the tent, Drummondoon fell into step beside him, his tall form bent close as he said, "Did he listen to you?" Pied nodded. "He listened. Then he ignored me. If I don't give him fresh reasons to call it off, the attack takes place at dusk. Worse, he intends to take his sons along for the ride." Drummondoon exhaled sharply. "Has he lost his mind?"
"Arling would think so. I wish she were here to speak with him. She might have better luck than I."
Drummondoon shook his head. "I doubt it. He doesn't listen to her either, although he might where those boys are concerned. What matters is that she left them in your charge, yours specifically. I was there when she did so. I heard the way she spoke to you. If anything happens to her sons, she will have your head."
Pied glanced at him. "Because I loved her once. Because I think she loved me as well. You left that part out, Drum."
He stalked off into the midday heat and tried not to think about it.
Chapter 19. By late afternoon, Akrolasi and Parn had still not returned. It worried Pied, but he had learned long ago to live with the guilt associated with sending his home guard to spy on an enemy. It was obvious, in any case, that Akrolasi and Parn were not going to return in time to be of any help in dissuading Kellan Elysidil from his ill-advised foray. The attack on the Federation fleet was going to happen whether he wanted it to or not, and he was just going to have to make the best of it. That was sometimes a soldier's lot, even if you were captain of the home guard and cousin to the king. Dressed in his battle gear, his weapons strapped about him once more, he called Drummondoon to his tent, and with the sun creeping toward the horizon through a screen of thin clouds and the daylight becoming diffuse and weak, they set out for the airship field.
"No word of any sort, Drum?"
The aide shook his head.
"Nothing.
I hear that the Federation is massing soldiers along its lines, looking to shore up the weaknesses brought about by the departure of the rovers. That's the king's reading of the situation, at least. It reinforces what he already believes, which makes it attractive. It supports the decision he favors. Word is he sees this war over and done within a week."
"Celebrating his victory before he's even engaged his enemy. How very like him."
Pied shook his head.
"Something is going on that we don't know about. I can feel it in my bones. This attack is a mistake. I have to find a way to stop it."
Drummondoon pursed his lips. "I don't know this for a fact, but I am given to understand that the king hasn't advised our allies as yet of his plans." Pied came to an abrupt halt, staring at him.
"What?"
"He intends to inform them just before he sets out, I'm told. That way they can't stop him." His aide cocked an eyebrow at him. "He doesn't want to risk anything or anyone getting in his way. He knows he isn't commander of the Freeborn Army, that he isn't even commander of the airship fleet. But he is king of the elves, and the elves make up the greater part of the airship command. So, in his mind, that's sufficient justification for striking out on his own."
Drummondoon glanced around warily, making sure no one else was listening.
"Captain, he doesn't intend to ask for support from any quarter in this business. He intends this victory to belong solely to the elves. Dwarves, trolls, and bordermen can share in it afterwards, once it has been realized. But ultimately, it is the elves who will bring it about. That's what they say he's decided."
Pied fumed. How had he not seen that coming?
For more than 2 months, Kellan Elysidil had camped on the Preken Doran with his elven hunters, an inspiring presence and little more on the face of things. But Kellan Elysidil was nothing if not driven. You could see it in his impatience with the failure of the Freeborn Army to effect any noticeable change in the status quo. Always anxious to be in the thick of things, always looking to see how matters so long stalemated might be resolved, the king was pressing his fellow commanders at every opportunity. The war was more than 30 years old, and the elves were sick to death of it. The king saw it as his moral imperative to bring it to a conclusion, and no one could fault him for his commitment to do so. What was wrong with his approach was his insistence on doing it his way, on finding a solution that did not necessarily involve his freeborn allies. What was mistaken in his thinking was that the solution existed in simple terms, that somehow the answer lay in a single, brilliant military stroke, and that the finding of that answer had been left up to him. Well, it was too late to try to explain it to him now, even supposing he would be willing to listen, which Pied was quite sure he would not. He started walking again, more purposefully, a mix of irritation and concern flooding through him. King or not, Kellen Elysidil was overstepping his bounds, and it would come back to haunt them all. Drummondune matched his strides to those of his captain, and kept his peace while he did so. Neither of them spoke. There had been enough talk already. Pied surveyed the camp as they passed through it, taking careful note of what he saw. This section was mostly elven. Those farther on, east of where they walked, comprised bordermen from the larger cities of Callahorn, as well as dwarves and trolls, most of the latter mercenaries. The nominal leader of the army was an aged, though highly respected, Southlander named Droshen. But the real leader, the man who commanded the soldiers on the battlefield, was a dwarf called Vaden Wick, a veteran of countless campaigns against the gnome tribes before coming to the Precandoran. Just now, coordination of the various allied forces was loose, a condition brought about by the near inactivity of the armies on either side of the conflict over the past few years, an erosion of structure and discipline through constant changes in both ranks and command. The third generation of allies was fighting the war, and the toll was noticeable. It was assumed by most that the war would end only when the leaders finally grew so tired of it that they called it off by mutual agreement. No one thought it could be won on the battlefield, not after so long, not after so many failed attempts. Except, of course, for a few who thought like Kellen Elysidil. Pied was disconcerted by what he saw that evening. The obvious lack of discipline was worrisome. The looks on the faces of the men and women as they sat around their fires, playing games of chance and drinking ale, were more worrisome still. Disinterest and resignation were mirrored in those faces. That spoke to him clearly. No one believed in the war anymore. It said that everyone was sick of the fighting and dying. It said that keeping your head down and your mouth shut was all that would get you through. These men and women were waiting things out. They were waiting to go home. He glanced around. No one drilled or trained. No one sharpened weapons or tightened straps on armor. There were elven hunters manning the walls at the front, and there was a watch in place. That was enough. If something more was needed, it was somebody else's problem. It was worse elsewhere, in the other armies, where discipline was even less in evidence. It wasn't that bordermen, dwarves, and trolls weren't brave and capable. It was that they had no reason to think those attributes would be tested. The Federation army had squatted in place for almost 2 years without doing anything beyond sending out scouts and attempting an occasional foray into the freeborn lines. They were as indolent and disinterested in fighting as their enemies were. The mobilization of fresh forces along the Federation front in the wake of the departure of the rover airships did not suggest to the elves and their allies that their enemies' attitude had changed. Pied glanced over at Drummondune and gestured toward the encampment. "They don't seem to have much to do with their time, do they?" Drum said nothing. There was nothing to say. He was of the same mind as his captain. The home guard had a different approach to discipline than everyone else, but that was why they were home guard. The rest of the army regarded them as curiosities. They were a small unit assigned a single task: to protect the king. The way they conducted themselves, others believed, was mostly the result of the suspicion that the king was always watching them. When they reached the heights, Pied paused. The front, stretched along the plateau that comprised the Precandoran for more than 2 miles east and west,
through a series of broad flats segmented by twisting passes and ravines. At present, and for much of the past 20 years, the Freeborn had occupied a pair of high bluffs bracketing a deep, wide pass that angled north all the way to the other side of the plateau before turning down through the foothills beyond. Elves occupied the smaller bluff on the west, a mix of bordermen, dwarves, and trolls, the larger one on the east. By placing archers and slingmen on either side of the gap, where it narrowed, they were able to ward against penetration. The Federation's only choice was to come at the Allies from the front or sides, and to do so from a highly vulnerable position. The Federation had penetrated deep into the flats early on in the war, but once the Allies had found the bluffs on which to set their defenses, the attack had stalled. Because the Federation was the invading force, the Allies could afford to sit back and wait. It was the invader who must come to them, and by now they had constructed defenses of stone and timber that were believed to be sufficiently strong that it would cost the lives of thousands of men to achieve a breakthrough. It was generally agreed by both sides that another way must be found, and as yet it had not. Pied studied the Federation lines, situated on the flats not half a mile away. A mass of dark figures crowded behind fortifications similar to their own. In the 2 months he had been on the front, they had not emerged from behind those walls. The most excitement he had experienced was the result of a pair of rather haphazard airship attacks on the dwarf lines a mile farther down the front, which had been quickly driven back. Were there more Federation soldiers at those walls than there had been a week ago? A mottled stain of black and silver uniforms spread away behind those fortifications for better than a mile, clusters of men settled about cooking fires and stacks of weapons. There was no drilling or training in evidence, no suggestion of an impending attack. Everything looked as it always looked. But that didn't mean it was. He shook his head. He didn't like anything he was seeing on either side of the front. He had been a soldier all his life, and he had learned to trust his instincts. They were screaming at him, telling him that the possibility of disaster was enormous and close at hand. "Drum, I can't let him do this," he said quietly. "The king?" His aide shook his head. "You can't stop him, Captain. You've already tried, and he won't listen. If you can't tell him something he doesn't already know, you'll just make him more determined." Pied walked on, saying nothing. There had to be a way to stall, something he could say or do to win a reprieve. He had always been able to outthink Kellen. He ought to be able to do so now. Ahead, the airfield came into view, settled in a swale at the center of the encampment east, close to the draw that separated the Allied armies. There was noticeable activity, even from a distance. Ships were being readied for liftoff, crews scurrying across the decks and atop the rigging, tightening draws and loosening sails. Railguns were already fitted in place, and missiles were stacked in boxes beside them. 2 dozen airships were set to fly, the larger part of the fleet, the best of the warships it comprised. The king was determined that the attack would succeed, holding nothing back against the possibility that it wouldn't. As he descended from the higher flat, Pied caught sight of the king grouped with his airship commanders in a tight circle by the flagship, Ellenroe, talking. The discussion appeared heated, but all the heat was coming from the king. His captains were doing little more than listening. Then Pied caught sight of Kyrus and Wensling standing off to one side of their father, and his heart sank. The king had decided to take his sons with him after all. In spite of Pied's reservations, in spite of his advice, his nephews were looking at their feet, trying not to draw attention to themselves, staring ill at ease and out of place, and he guessed they didn't like the idea of being there any better than he did. Taking a deep breath, he walked across the airfield and up to the king. "Captain," the king greeted on catching sight of him. He would never use Pied's name or refer to their familiar relationship in a situation like this.
We are ready to depart. No word, I gather, from your scouts? No? Then we have no further reason to delay.
My lord, I wish you would reconsider, Pied said quickly. I would feel better for your safety if we waited just one more day. My scouts should return.
My safety is in good hands with these men, the king interrupted, an edge to his voice.
I thought we had settled this earlier, captain.
Was there something I said that wasn't clear to you?
There was no mistaking the anger in his voice. He did not care to be challenged in front of his airship captains and his sons, and particularly not about the coming attack. He was telling Pied he had gone as far as he was going to be allowed to go, and that he had better not try to go farther. But Pied had no choice, not if he was to keep his self-respect.
My lord, you made yourself perfectly clear. I respect your thinking, but I have been a soldier for a long time, and I have learned to trust my instincts. They tell me that something isn't right about what we're seeing, about the unexplained rover departure and weakening of the Federation fleet. Nor do I feel right about the mobilization reported along the Federation front. I know it seems to be in response to the rover departure, but I think it might be something else. If I could suggest an alternative plan, my lord, I would ask you to take an exploratory flight to see.
Enough, captain, the king snapped, cutting him short.
There was a hushed silence. The king was seething.
More than enough. You are captain of the Home Guard. Limit yourself to that, and leave the decision-making to me.
As captain of the Home Guard, I am responsible for your safety and must do everything in my power to protect you, Pied snapped back.
I can't do that if you won't let me.
The silence turned as frosty as midwinter in the charnels. Pied caught a glimpse of the shocked faces of the king's sons, who stared at him in disbelief. Kiris, tall and dark like his father, and Wensling, fair and small like his mother. No one talked that way to their father, certainly not outside the family, and not in public. Pied had crossed the line, but his conscience refused to let him back down. Kellen Elisadil turned away.
Captains, he addressed his airship commanders, prepare to set out. Board everyone. Make certain they know what is expected of them.
He gestured to a messenger standing off to one side.
Carry the message I gave you to Commanders Droshen and Wick. Go quickly, and tell them to take whatever precautions they feel necessary in case of a counterattack. Make certain they know that I have already left.
When everyone was gone but his sons, he turned back to Pied. You have abused your position as captain of the Home Guard. As a consequence, you will not be coming with me. I don't trust you anymore. You've lost your nerve. I don't want my life or the lives of my family and soldiers in your hands. You are relieved of your duties. My safety is no longer your responsibility. Perhaps others, more capable of understanding the nature of your office, will serve me better.
He paused. Just because my wife still favors you, a kindness she would do well to reconsider, doesn't give you the right to question me as you have just done. In front of my sons and my officers.
He turned to his sons, beckoned for them to follow, and stalked angrily toward the Ellenrow. Pied watched them go, stunned. He should say something more, he knew. He should make another attempt to stop him, or maybe just try to explain himself better. But he couldn't make himself move. He was still standing there when the airships lifted off like huge hunting birds and swung south toward the Federation lines. Drummondoon, who had waited patiently in the background until Pied's attention had shifted away from the departing vessels, came up to him.
He will change his mind, Captain, the aide said quietly. He will realize he acted out of haste.
Perhaps. There was an awkward silence as they faced each other.
I couldn't think of anything else to say, Drum. I just stood there and let him walk away from me.
His aide nodded and gave a faint smile. Maybe there weren't any words left to be said. They walked back across the airfield and into the elven encampment in silence. Now and again, Pied cast anxious glances toward the Federation lines, where the first torches were being lit with twilight's approach. He could still see the elven warships, dark smudges pinned against the sky. He searched for ground activity, but saw none. It was hard to tell, though, so far away and in poor light. His thoughts drifted. He had grown up with Kellen Elysadil, and there were few men or women who knew him better. He should have been able to devise a more effective approach to dissuading him from making an ill-advised attack. He should have been able to avoid angering him so. Somehow things had gotten out of hand, and he was still struggling with the fact of it. He could see the faces of Kyrus and Wensling in his mind, looking shocked and afraid, as if seeing what he hadn't seen, as if knowing secrets he should have known. He tried not to think what Arling would say once she discovered how badly he had let her down. If she would talk to him at all, he amended. She might not. She might dismiss him as swiftly as Kellen had. "Captain," Drummondune said suddenly, taking his arm. A man was racing toward them from across the flats, one of his home guard. The man's name escaped him, though he knew it as well as his own. He struggled to remember it, and failed. "Fela," Drum whispered, as if reading his mind. Fela reached them in a rush and saluted. "Akralasi has returned, Captain," he exclaimed. His breath came in short, labored gasps. "She's badly injured. She says you are to come right away." They broke into a run, Fela leading the way. Pied didn't bother questioning the man. Akralasi was the one he needed to see. But the urgency of the summons frightened him. They reached a cluster of elves close to the edge of the bluff, just above the front of the elven defensive line. Akralasi lay on the ground, the silver and black Federation tunic she had donned as a disguise stained and torn, her left arm ripped open all the way from shoulder to elbow. She was pale from loss of blood and rigid with pain. Her green eyes found his as he knelt beside her, and her fingers fastened on his wrist. He bent close to hear her, his eyes never leaving hers. "What happened, Akralasi?" he whispered. "Where's Parn?" She shook her head.
"Dead,"
she swallowed thickly.
"They have an airship."
She coughed, and blood bubbled on her lips.
"Under heavy guard. No one allowed close, but we got near enough."
She trailed off, her eyes closing against pain or memory. He couldn't tell which. When she opened them again, he squeezed her hand. "What did you see?"
"A weapon mounted on the deck. Big. Something new."
She inhaled sharply.
"They're waiting for us, Captain. They know we're coming. We heard them say so."
She gave a long, slow sigh, and her hand released its grip on his. "A weapon," he repeated silently. "She's unconscious," one of the healers said. "Better so." Pied looked around quickly, trying not to panic. "Fela," he said, spotting his home guard messenger, "find Commander Fraxen. Tell him I said to expect a Federation attack. Tell him it will be massive, a push to break all the way through our lines. Tell him it will come at any time and to have his elven hunters ready. Hurry!" He stood up. "Drum. Call up all elements of the home guard and place them on the airfield. They are to hold it at all costs. All costs, Drum, until I tell them to stand down." His aide nodded, his long face as pale as Akralasi's. "Where will you be? What will you do?" Pied was already hurrying away, his determination etched on his lean features. "I'm going after the king," he called over his shoulder. "This time, he will have to listen to me." Chapter 20. Pied Sanderling sprinted the length of the elven encampment, bumping aside anyone who got in his way, knocking over equipment and stores, leaving in his wake a string of angry shouts and curses. His mind was already far ahead of his body, thinking of what he must do and how he must do it, aware of how futile his efforts were likely to be. A terrible certainty gripped him. He was going to be too late. No matter how quick he wasn't going to be quick enough. The disaster he had feared had come to pass, and all the failed warnings in the world would not be enough to persuade him it was not his fault. Run faster! He reached the airfield winded and flushed, and as he tore down the embankment toward the airships, he searched frantically for someone he recognized among the few who hadn't gone with Kellen Elysadil. He found only a lone commander of a railgun sloop, a grizzled veteran named Markenstall. He barely knew the man, knew more of his reputation than of him, a brave man, dependable in a fight, a solid presence in the pilot box. That would suffice. "Captain," he shouted, rushing up to the older man, "is your sloop fitted and ready?" He glanced at her name, carved into the stern. Asa Scheele. Markenstall stared at him with a mix of surprise and doubt. Gray whiskers stuck out from the sides of his jaw, deep lines furrowed his withered face, and his ears were tattered and scarred. He had the look of a man who had been in more than a few fights. "Answer me, Captain," Pied shouted at him. The older man started sharply. "Ready and fitted as she can be, Captain Sanderling," he growled. "Good. We're taking her up. Cast off." Markenstall hesitated. "Captain, I'm not authorized to—" "Listen carefully to me," Pied interrupted. "The king flies into a trap. One of my home guard nearly lost her life getting that news to me. Another lies dead somewhere beyond our lines. I'm not about to let that be for nothing. There isn't time to seek authorization of any sort. If you want to save the king and those who went with him, we must leave at once." He cast a quick glance south, where the sky had turned deep blue in the twilight haze, and the airships his gaze had followed earlier had disappeared from view. The dusk was thickening, the last of the sunlight a dim glow below the horizon west, the first stars beginning to brighten in the sky north. East, the moon was a silvery crescent lifting out of the lower Anar. His eyes flicked back to Markenstall. "Captain, please." The veteran studied him a moment longer, then nodded. "Very well. Get aboard." He turned to a pair of sailors sitting nearby. "Pon, Kresk, off your duffs and get aboard. Take in the lines and anchors. Prepare to cast off." The two crewmen and the grizzled captain were skilled at making quick departures, and the Asa Scheele was airborne in minutes, swinging south with the wind, tacking swiftly out across the flats and beyond the freeborn lines. Pied stood in the pilot box with Markenstall, while the crewmen manned the rail guns to either side, breeches opened and loaded, triggers unlocked. No one mistook the foray for anything but what Pied was certain it was going to turn out to be. "Mind if I ask what it is you intend to do with a sloop and two rail guns?" Markenstall asked, once they were winging out over the desolate front, a hint of sarcasm in his voice. Pied shook his head. "Whatever I can." Ahead, the Federation lines were so dark they were virtually indistinguishable from the surrounding land. Pied thought he heard shouting, the sounds of sudden activity, but it was hard to tell with the rush of the wind and the whine of the rigging in his ears. Then, lightning split the darkness, brilliant and piercing. The bolt, a horizontal rope stretched low and taut against the horizon. The bolt struck something that exploded instantly into a fiery ball, burning fragments pinwheeling into the darkness to fall like tiny firebrands to the earth. For just an instant, a cluster of airships was silhouetted against the brightness, masts and hulls stark and black.
"Shades!" Markenstall hissed. "What was that?"
Pied swiftly amended his earlier conclusion. It wasn't lightning after all, not riding that low and that straight. Then it flashed again, and there was another explosion. This one more violent than the first, and again the airships were revealed, scattering in all directions now, angling away from the fireball like frightened animals. An earth-shattering boom reverberated through the night, the shock waves so powerful that Pied could feel them even through the deck of the sloop. He knew then what it was.
It was the weapon Akralasi and Parn had discovered in the Federation camp. The trap had been sprung. Kellan Elysidil's airships were being destroyed, one by one. Pied was too late to give warning. He was too late to do anything but witness the consequences of the king's ill-considered, rash behavior.
"Faster, Captain," he said, catching hold of Markenstall's wiry arm. "We have to try to help."
It was a faint hope at best. There was little one airship could do to help another in the best of situations, which this most assuredly wasn't, and his was likely the weakest airship aloft. But he had to get a closer look. He had to know what the elves and their allies were up against. If the king didn't get safely back, if none of them managed to get back. He forced the thought away, hating himself for allowing it to surface. But another firebolt erupted, and another airship caught fire, the flames turning masts and rigging into torches that illuminated the whole of the night sky. Stricken, the airship wheeled away from the attack, trying to stay aloft, to seek cover. But there was no cover in the skies, and no place to hide when you were burning. A second strike turned it into a massive fireball. It blazed brightly for a moment, then fell apart and disappeared into the dark.
"Shades!" Markenstall whispered again in shocked disbelief.
They were close enough by then that Pied could make out the vague shapes of the elven airships as they wheeled this way and that to avoid the huge Federation airship that was in pursuit. Her name, emblazoned across her upswept bow, was the Dectera. The terrible weapon was affixed to her decking. Pied could just make out its armored bulk. Even as the shape of it registered, the man-made lightning exploded out of it again, crackling with energy and power, a terrible, bright lance through the enfolding night, burning everything in its path. It caught pieces of two ships this time, nicking the hull of one, boring holes through the sails of another. It was firing blindly, Pied saw, unable to distinguish its targets clearly in the darkness. The moon was behind a bank of clouds, and the starlight was still too thin. The elven airships might have a chance if they fled now, if they turned around, if they raced for the safety of their own lines. Incredibly, they did not. Instead, they attacked. It was suicide, but it was exactly what Kellan Elysidil would do, refusing to quit a battle, ready to die first.
"He will get his wish here," Pied thought in horror.
The Federation weapon was firing into the elven airships as they drew near enough to distinguish, and they were exploding, one after the other. The king was trying to ram the Federation ship, to damage it sufficiently that it could be forced down, perhaps even made to crash. He was intent on salvaging something out of this disaster, but he could not seem to recognize that it was already too late for that.
"What in the name of everything sane is he doing?"
Markenstall whispered in disbelief, recognizing at once the futility of the effort.
"Committing suicide," Pied thought.
Trying to ram the bigger ship in the mistaken belief that by doing so he could still save his fleet. But he wasn't even going to get close. Already the Dectera was firing at the Elenro. A series of short, sharp bursts that set the elven flagship on fire in several places and brought down the foremast. Still, Kellan came on, his railguns raking the enemy's decks. But the weapon that was destroying his fleet was protected behind heavy metal shields that the railguns could barely scratch. Another burst set the Elenro's mainsail on fire. And now the airship was lurching badly, her sails gone, and one or more of her parse tubes damaged or blown away.
"No, Kellan," Pied whispered. "Land her. Get her down now before she..."
A fresh burst from the Federation weapon rocked the big elven flagship from bow to stern, striking with such force that it knocked her backwards. The Elenro shuddered and bucked, then exploded in a blinding ball of fire that consumed everything and everyone aboard. In seconds, she was gone. Pied stared in stunned silence, unable to accept what he had witnessed. The king... gone. Kyrus and Wensling. Gone. The biggest warship in the elven fleet, together with every last one of the men and women who crewed her, vanished.
"Captain Sanderling," Markenstall hissed in his ear, and he jerked around in response. What do we do?
The Dectera had turned her attention to what was left of the Elven fleet, a handful of airships only, three of which were already settling onto the flats. The plains were swarming with Federation soldiers marching toward the Elven lines, a dark stain that spread like ink on old parchment. Thousands, Pied judged. He watched the damaged airships fall into the mass of charging men. He watched the men swarm up the sides of the ships and onto the decks. Then he quit looking. His eyes flicked back to the fleet under attack once more from the Federation killing machine. The Dectera was moving after them, overtaking them one at a time, burning them out of the sky the way an archer might shoot down a flock of trapped geese. She shouldn't have been able to do that, as big and cumbersome-looking as she was. She must be powered by an abnormally high number of crystals, her stored energy capacity twice that of any other ship of the line. Some of the Elven ships were dropping toward the plains now, trying to use the enemy soldiers as cover so that they could not be fired upon from above. But the tactic wasn't working. The weapon aboard the big ship was too accurate to be deterred by the threat of what a miss would mean. It simply took its time, burning away the Elven ships, whether they fled or tried to hide. He looked at Markenstall. We have to do something, Captain. The older man nodded but kept silent. Can you get behind that Federation ship? Can you come up at her from below? The veteran stared at him. What do you intend to do? Disable her steering. Use the railguns to damage her rudders and thrusters from underneath, where they can't do anything about it without breaking off their attack and setting her down. He paused. We're small enough that they might not see us coming in from behind. Markenstall thought a moment. Maybe. But if they do see us, we won't have a chance. Railguns are only good from close in. From more than 50 yards will be so much target practice. Pied glanced quickly at the skyline. The moon remained covered by clouds, the light still something between dusk and full dark. Off to their left, the Dectera was hunting its Elven quarry like a big cat, stealthy and sure, striking with bursts of white fire that filled the night air with blinding explosions and a pungent, raw smell of ash and smoke and death. We can't just sit here and let this slaughter continue, he said quietly. Markenstall adjusted the controls without a word, swung the Asa shield toward the enemy camp, and sent her skimming over the heads of the advancing Federation soldiers, who fired up at them with bows and slings as they flew past. But they slipped through the darkness, unhindered and undamaged, and soon they were behind their target, staying low so that they would not be silhouetted against the horizon, approaching in a gradual ascent that kept them carefully masked from view. But suddenly, new airships began to lift off from the Federation airfield, fresh reinforcements setting out to lend support to the ground attack on the Freeborn camp, their dark shapes like hunting birds as they swung about to place the sloop directly in their path. Captain, Piet exclaimed with a sharp intake of breath. Markenstall nodded. I see them. Warn the men on the railguns. Pied left the pilot box in a rush, scuttling across the deck to Pawn and Kresk, his safety harness dragging behind him and alerted each of the crewmen to this new danger. He found himself wishing they had something besides railguns with which to work, but there was nothing to be done about that. Moments later, he was back beside Markenstall. The night had gone black again, the moon disappeared once more behind the clouds, and the air turned brisk and chilly. Pied shivered in spite of himself, wishing he had thought to throw on warmer clothing. He glanced out at the cluster of rising Federation airships. At least half a dozen were advancing in their direction. They're gaining on us, Markenstall announced. I don't think they see us yet, but they will soon enough. We can't wait, Captain Sanderling. We have to take a chance. What do you mean? We have to gain speed and altitude both. Get above the heavier air and into the wind and closer to that ship. The other man paused. We have to let them see us. If we don't, they're going to find us anyway. We don't have time to be clever or cautious about this. Pied hesitated. He knew Markenstall was right, but he hated the thought of exposing the sloop when they had so few weapons with which to defend themselves. Once they were spotted, the other ships would be after them like cats after a mouse. That would give them only a single pass, barring a miracle, at their target.
All right, he said. Do your best, but find a way to get us close to that ship.
Hold on, Markenstall said, and he pushed the thruster levers all the way forward.
The Asashiel bucked and shot ahead. The Mouse was in flight. They rose swiftly into the sky, abandoning the comparative safety of the darkness for the revealing light of stars and moon, for the latter was emerging from behind the clouds. Fresh illumination bathed the Precandoran in brilliant white light, revealing the hordes of attackers surging toward the elven defensive lines. Already, they were flooding the gap between the twin bluffs occupied by the elves and their allies, breaking down the elven fortifications and scrambling onto the airfield, where the last of the elven airships were frantically lifting off. All across the battlefield, the remains of the destroyed ships burned fiercely, signal fires for the advancing army, encouragement for its soldiers. Pied saw the Elenrose hull, a charred, smoking wreck at the center of everything.
You should have listened to me, Kellen, Pied thought.
He closed his eyes. I should have found a way to make you listen. They were approaching their target now. The Dectera was right ahead of them, her bulk blocking out an entire section of the sky. She was huge, a flying platform supported by four sets of pontoons, with cross bracing running all along her underside. Three masts flew yards of light sheaths, radian draws feeding banks of parse tubes housing the diapson crystals that powered her, metal shields opening and closing in sudden bursts of converted energy as the ship maneuvered first this way and then that, bringing the deadly weapon mounted on the foredeck to bear. No one aboard seemed to realize yet that the Asashiel was tracking her. All eyes were directed forward to where another elven ship was under attack, a rope of fire burning through her, sizzling and exploding wood and metal in a booming cough that rocked the sloop with concussive force. Burning bodies flew over the railings of the stricken airship, tumbling to the earth like stricken fireflies. Pied made a quick, agonizing survey. Only three elven airships remained aloft of the 12 or so that had started out. The fleet was decimated.
Quick, Captain, he hissed at Markenstall, before we lose any more.
The Asashiel was right below the Dectera now, and Markenstall angled her to the port side, away from the approaching vessels that by now had surely spied them, giving his crew a chance to position the railguns where they could do the most damage. He, too, knew they would have only one pass. The big ship was moving forward in a slow, steady line, a fresh target already in sight, still oblivious to them. They were going to have a clean shot at her underside. The men on the railguns had swung their weapons into position and were sighting down the long barrels, waiting patiently. Pied glanced over his shoulder. Their pursuers were closing on them, and he could see the frantic efforts of some of the crew to give warning to the men on the Dectera.
Release! Markenstall shouted.
Both railguns discharged at the same instant, sending a hail of metal shards into the underside of the Federation ship, the missiles striking with explosive impact. Pied had just enough time to see two of the parse tubes disintegrate entirely and the main rudder collapse, and then Markenstall was swinging the Asashiel away, speeding out from under the damaged enemy, a tiny gnat in flight from a giant bird. They emerged from beneath the warship's shadow into a sky awash with moonlight and were immediately exposed. The railguns on the decking of the enemy swung toward them, but Markenstall dropped the sloop below their angle of fire, skimming the flats once more, content to take his chances with the missiles fired from the foot soldiers. But it wasn't over yet. A line of white fire sizzled past their mainmast, snapping off one of the spars, burning away wood and sail, and knocking the Asashiel sideways.
Brace!
Markenstall shouted automatically, grabbing on to the railing to keep upright. Reaching for the thruster levers, he jammed them all the way forward, then sent the sloop into a stomach-churning dive.
We should have taken a shot at that weapon, too, Pied snapped at the veteran.
The captain righted their wounded vessel not 50 feet above the flats and lurched away from the deadly Federation weapon. Pied glanced over his shoulder. The Dectera hung silhouetted against the moonlit sky. She was still moving forward,
but he saw that her course was fixed and undeviating. At least one, and possibly both, shots from the sloop's railguns had done the job. The steering was damaged, and the vessel was unable to come about. He exhaled sharply. The big ship was slowing down. The other Federation warships were coming up from behind, preparing to offer help. It occurred to him that now was the perfect time for that attack Kellen Elysadil had been so anxious to launch, the perfect opportunity to destroy that ship and the weapon she bore. But the bulk of the Elven fleet was in flames, and the ships of Callahorn were still on the ground somewhere east. He looked down at the flats, swarming with Federation soldiers, then at the Elven defensive lines. He remembered the faces of the men and women he had seen earlier, weary and disinterested. He remembered the lack of discipline evident everywhere. He was not encouraged. The Elven airfield had been overrun. The remainder of the fleet fled north. If their ground defenses held through the night, it would be a miracle. An impossible miracle, he amended, without help from the freeborn allies. And in the end, it might not matter anyway. By week's end, the Dectero would be airborne again and would fly in support of the Federation attack, her terrible weapon primed and ready for use. What it had done to the Elven airships was nothing compared to what it would do to the Elven army. The implications of his thinking did not escape him. The war on the Preken Doran was about to take a disastrous turn, and he wasn't sure there was anything that could be done about it. They were flying over the captured Elven airfield now, heading west toward the besieged Elven lines. "Captain," he called to Markenstall. The wind came up again in a sudden rush, tearing at his words. The veteran turned. "Can you fly us to where—" He never finished. White fire lanced through the center of the airship in a searing rope of brightness that slammed the entire craft sideways with such force that Pied was thrown from the pilot box, catapulting over its railing. He caught a glimpse of the mast going up like a torch, the flames spurting skyward as the sails caught fire. Both rail guns and crew disappeared into an explosion of sizzling light. The sloop lurched wildly, bucked, and began to drop.
"Markenstall," he called weakly.
There was no response. His safety line was still attached to its ring inside the pilot box, but he was tangled so thoroughly in the rigging that he couldn't move. He tried to lift himself to see what was happening inside the box itself, and failed. There was blood on his face, warm and sticky, running down his neck and arm. He had thought them safely away from the Federation warship and her terrible weapon. He had been mistaken. Its range must be enormous. Even from the better part of a mile away, it had managed to fix on them. Even now, after the fact, Pied could not imagine it. He felt the sloop plunge earthward with sickening speed. He closed his eyes and waited for the impact. Chapter 21. It took Penderyn Ohmsford and his companions almost a week to navigate the maze of passes and defiles that wound through the Clue Mountains, although they did not again encounter the treacherous combination of mist and clouds that had very nearly prevented their initial escape from Taupo Ruff. With Kermadec leading, steady and assured now in his choice of routes, they pressed on without needing to rely on Penn or Cinnaminson to find the way. Nor did they see anything further of their druid pursuers, although Tagwin was quick to point out, when the subject was raised, that not seeing them didn't mean they weren't out there. Once before they had thought themselves safe, only to discover how badly they were mistaken. If the druids hunting them were doing so on orders from Shadea Aru, they were not likely to give up easily, the dwarf insisted. But it was the use of the elf stones that had brought Taric Molt and the Gallifile down on them in the slags, Penn thought. As long as they were able to refrain from using the stones, they should be able to keep Trant Rowan and the Balin Darroch from finding them here. After all, he reasoned, if the druid and his cohorts had magic that would enable them to find the little company, they certainly would have done so already. That they hadn't shown themselves even once suggested they were hunting blind. Nevertheless, as the little company pressed on through the mountains, Penn found himself glancing skyward periodically to make certain he was not making a mistake. It was late in the day, the sun already sinking into the jaws of the peaks west, when they climbed through a particularly nasty tangle of switchbacks to a ledge that overlooked the broadest, darkest valley Penn had ever encountered. It was difficult to judge exactly how big the valley was. From so high up, there was no point of reference by which to measure accurately. Hundreds of square miles, perhaps? Even more? It sprawled in all directions, spilling out from its central cradle into passes and canyons, like the fingers of a giant's spread hand. At its eastern end, farthest from where they stood, it simply disappeared into mist and twilight, so densely packed with trees and brush that its shadows overlapped to create the impression of a lake thick and black with dead wood and weeds. "Anything might live in a place that looks like this," Penn thought, and he shivered in spite of himself.
"The Inkrim," Kermadec announced, his voice flat and unemotional, a perfect match for his stolid troll face. "Some say it is as old as the races, and that the things that live there are older still. Some say there are things living down there that are as old as faerie."
"Trees and dirt," Atalan muttered from behind Penn. "Nothing we haven't encountered before."
"And Urdas,"
Atalan snorted. "Savages." It seemed to Penn an odd comment coming from someone who looked vaguely like a walking tree stump, all bark and rough surfaces, as brutish and forbidding as anything that walked the four lands. Kermadec must have thought the same. He looked at Atalan carefully.
"Savages to us. But who are we to judge? In any event, I wouldn't be too quick to dismiss them. Urdas have lived in this valley since the destruction of the old world. This is their ancestral home, and they regard it as sacred, especially Stridegate. They will fight to protect it from outsiders, like the spider gnomes on Toffa Ridge. They worship the creatures that share their abode, a symbiotic relationship, however one-sided, that influences their attitude toward intruders like us." He paused. "There are a lot of them down there, brother."
"Not enough to stop us, brother," Atalan replied, giving an edge to the last word that left no doubt about how he viewed the relationship. "We are the stronger force, no matter how few we are." There was a hint of anger in Kermadec's eyes, and a muttering among the other rock trolls.
"You have never been down there," the Matterin said quietly. "I have. It isn't just trees and dirt. It isn't just Urdas, either. It is darkness of a different sort. Too many who thought as you do have disappeared into that darkness. If we are careless, we could end up the same way."
"Then we won't be careless, will we?" Atalan declared. His eyes flicked from his brother to Cinnaminson and Penn. "Lucky we have just the little people to help us. A blind girl who sees and a boy who speaks with lichen. What have we to fear?" He shouldered his way forward and started down off the ledge, not bothering to see who might follow. Kermadec watched him go for a moment, then glanced back at the rest of the company and motioned them ahead. The descent into the Inkrim was accomplished without incident. The trail down was not steep, though it was narrow and twisting, and at times even Penn, who was among the smallest, was forced to hug the cliff wall. The twilight deepened steadily all the while, and as it did so, the valley came alive. Hushed before the change of light to dark, it began to hum and buzz with insect life. Nightbirds called out, their cries piercing and shrill as they took to the air in shadowy flocks, and Penn could hear grunts from ground animals, some recognizable, some not. He listened carefully as he walked and tried to sort them out. He searched for what sounded familiar amid the cacophony and failed. At the bottom of the trail, the company made camp in a stand of fir. Even though they had reached the valley floor, they were still several thousand feet above sea level, cradled by the peaks of the Clue, and the air was clear and cold, and the sky brilliant with stars and moonlight. As on past nights, Kermadec would not allow a fire.
"Tomorrow," he promised.
By then, they would be deep enough into the territory of the Urdas that a fire would not draw druid notice, or, if spied, would not seem unusual to anyone searching for them. They would be risking discovery by the Urdas, of course, but that was a risk they were taking just by being there.
"The ruins of Stridegate lie much deeper in this valley, Pin,"
he told the boy later, when dinner had been consumed and they were sitting alone at the edge of the encampment. His blocky features were inscrutable, but his eyes were intense.
"Two more days, at least, and that's if we press ahead at a steady pace. I've been there the one time I was in this valley before. I remember their look. It isn't a sight you are likely to forget."
"And the island?" Pen pressed. "The one that contains the Tanaquil?" Overhearing their conversation, Kyber, Cinnaminson, and Tagwin had wandered over to join them. They sat down in a close circle, silent and attentive. Behind them, a pair of sentries had taken up positions just out of sight in the darkened trees. The rest of the rock trolls were settling in for the night, bulky forms lumbering through the darkness, the heavy clank and rasp of their weapons audible. Atalan was sitting not far away, hunched and unmoving, his back to his brother, his gaze directed into the forest dark.
"It is not an island of the sort you might imagine. It is surrounded not by water, but by a deep ravine choked with vines and trees. A single bridge spans its width, an ancient stone arch thousands of years old. It offers the only passage to the other side, but no one I know has ever crossed it."
"Why not?" Kyber asked at once. Kermadec shook his head.
"I am not superstitious in the manner of the Urdas, but I know the nature of the things that live within the Inkrum, and I respect the power they wield. A warding stone placed on the near side of the bridge forbids passage. I try to pay attention to such things when I can."
He paused.
"I was told that others did not. Some attempted to cross anyway. There were rumors of a great treasure. A few used the stone arch. A few went down into the ravine with the intention of climbing out the other side. None were ever seen again."
"Then how are we to cross?" Kyber sounded suspicious and didn't bother keeping it from her voice. "Why are we any different than these others who couldn't?"
Kermadec shrugged. "I don't know that we are. I only know that we have to find out."
He nodded toward Penn.
"It is what is needed if we are to save the Ard Ris."
He rose and walked back toward his sleeping trolls. As he passed Atalan, he reached down and touched his shoulder. His brother glanced up and said something. Kermadec kept walking. A moment later, Atalan rose and followed him. Kyber glanced at Pen and Tagwin. Her brow furrowed.
"I don't remember the Elfstones showing us anything about a bridge. I don't remember being warned about not being able to cross one."
"They don't always show you everything, do they?" Pen asked.
"I just think it odd that we're hearing about this for the first time now."
She looked angry.
"Did the King of the Silver River say anything to you about this?"
Pen shook his head.
"Nothing."
"He wasn't any happier than she was about the bridge and its warning. He told me to find the Tanaquil and ask it for a limb from which to fashion the Dark Wand, then to take the Dark Wand back to Paranor and use it to cross over into the Forbidding." His lips compressed. "Nothing about a bridge that no one is supposed to cross."
"What are the trolls doing?" Cinnaminson asked suddenly, her blind eyes directed toward the encampment.
The other three turned to look. The trolls were gathered in a circle,
all of them, including Kermadec and Atalan. They were down on one knee, their blocky heads lowered, their palms flat against the ground, murmuring what seemed to be a chant. Now and then, one of them lifted a hand momentarily to touch fingertips to his forehead or lips.
"They are speaking to the valley," Tagwin said, pulling absently at his beard. "They are asking that it protect them against the dark spirits that live within it. It is an old custom among the trolls to seek the protection of the land they pass through and might have to fight upon."
Then, one by one, starting with Kermadec, the trolls rose and walked around the circle, touching each troll atop his head before returning to his place and kneeling to be touched in turn.
"Now they are pledging their lives in support of each other, promising that they will stand together as brothers should the spirits bless them with their protection and guidance."
He cleared his throat.
"I don't believe in this nonsense myself, but it seems to make them feel better."
The ritual continued for several minutes more. Then the trolls rose and moved off, the sentries to their posts, the rest to their beds. Only Kermadec and Atalan remained where they were, talking quietly.
"Guess they've made their peace,"
Tagwin stretched and yawned.
"I'm going to bed. Good night to all of you."
He moved off, and seconds later, Kyber went too. Penn sat alone with Cinnaminson in the darkness, their shoulders touching as they listened to the forest sounds.
"This valley is filled with spirits," the rover girl said to him suddenly. Her fingers reached up to brush the air. "I can sense them all around, watching." She paused. "I think they might have been waiting for us. I don't know why they would do that, but they are very purposeful in their movements, very deliberate."
"Maybe they are here because they were called just now by the trolls," Penn glanced at her. "Maybe they have come in response." The girl nodded.
"They might be here to offer protection. I don't sense hostility."
She touched his hand.
"I have an idea, Penn. Use your magic to ask them. You can communicate with living things of all sorts. Spirits are alive. See if they will speak to you."
He looked off into the velvet darkness, into the massed trees toward the black wall of the Inkrim, and wondered how to go about it. It began, in most cases, with whoever or whatever he was trying to communicate with making a sound or movement that he could interpret. A hawk might reveal its hunger or its desire for a mate through its cries. A rabbit might convey its fear by the way it looked at him. The way a small bird flew could reveal its urgency to reach its young. The brush of tree limbs or tall grasses against his face could tell him if they were in need of water. The movement of the wind told him of storms. He had once been warned of a wolf when a tiny ground squirrel darted through dried leaves. But there was nothing to hear or see in this situation. Spirits did not always have a voice. They did not always take form. He would have to try something else. He leaned forward and placed his hands against the earth, trying to read something from the feel of the ground. But after several minutes of patient concentration, there was still no response.
"No, Penn," Cinnaminson whispered suddenly, taking his hands and lifting them away. "These are spirits of the air. Reach up to them."
He did as she bid, holding up his hands with his fingers spread as if to catch the feel of the wind. He held them steady, then moved them slowly about, groping for contact. A moment later, he had it. Something brushed against his fingers ever so softly, just for a moment, before it was gone. Then something else grazed his arm. He read purpose in those touchings. He found life. They were as gossamer as spider webbing and as ephemeral as birdsong, but they were old and therefore strong too. They had lived a long time and seen a great deal. He could tell all that from a single touching. and it shocked him. But they were gone as quickly as they had come, and they didn't return. After he told Cinnaminson what he had felt, he tried to reach for them several times more and could not find them.
"They are not ready for us to know them," the rover girl said. "We must be patient. They will reveal themselves when they are ready."
Later, wrapped in his blanket, Penn thought for a long time before he drifted off to sleep about what form that revelation might take. They set out at daybreak, moving into the heavy woods while the shadows still layered the earth in dark patches and the sunlight was a dim glow east through the canopy of the trees. The air was chilly and smelled of earth grown rich and fecund over time. The night sounds were gone, replaced by morning birdsong and the soft rustle of the wind through the leaves. The woods remained dark and deep, as impenetrable to sight as a midnight pond, looking exactly the same in all directions, the trees and grasses a wall against the outside world. They traveled in single file, Kermadec leading, Atalan acting as rear guard, and Penn and his companions placed squarely in the center of the line. The boy walked with Cinnaminson, his eyes sweeping the forest, his senses alert. He searched the shadows and treetops for life, and more often than not, he found it. The Inkrum hummed with activity, its life forms a surprise at every turn. The birds were often strange, colored and plumed in unfamiliar ways. There were small ground animals that reminded him of squirrels and chipmunks, but were something else. This valley and the creatures that lived within it were old, Kermadec had said, and that suggested that their origins could be found in the world that had existed before the Great Wars. Certainly, nothing of the world Penn knew seemed to have a place here. The day wore on, and the sun lifted into the mountain sky, but little of its light penetrated to the forest floor. The night shadows remained thick and unbroken, and the air stayed cool and crisp. There was a twilight feel to the valley, a peculiar absence of real daylight and summer warmth. The woods produced their own climate, peculiarly suitable to this valley. Now and then they would cross a trail, narrow and poorly defined. The tracks meandered and ended abruptly, and there was little about them to suggest that they might lead to anything. Kermadec followed them when it was convenient to do so, but more often than not, kept to the off-trail breaks in the trees that offered easiest passage and clearest vision of their surroundings. He did not seem particularly concerned about what might be hiding from them and spent no noticeable time searching the deep shadows. Perhaps his training and experience reassured him that he would sense any danger lying in wait. Perhaps it was his acceptance of the fact that in a place like this, ancient and secretive, there was only so much you could do to protect yourself. Though he searched carefully at every turn, Penn did not see anything that day that seemed threatening. While at times the forest appeared dark and menacing, nothing dangerous ever materialized. On the second day, things changed. They had enjoyed a fire and hot food the night before, the first of both in a week. They had drunk strong-flavored ale from skins the trolls carried and slept undisturbed through the night. Rested and refreshed, they had set out again at dawn. This day looked very much like the first. The skies were more cloudy and the light paler, but the forests of the Inkrim seemed unchanged. Nevertheless, Penn felt a difference in things almost at once, a subtle distinction that at first lacked a source. It was only after he had been walking a while that he realized that the forest sounds were quieter, the wind softer, and the air warmer. Even these didn't seem to him to be the source of the problem, and he was plagued by a nagging certainty that he was missing something. "Does everything seem all right to you?" he asked Cinnaminson finally. "You sense them too, don't you?" she replied at once. She was walking next to him, keeping close. He stared at her, then glanced around quickly, scanning the forest shadows, the deep, mottled black and green of the trunks and grasses, of the limbs and leaves. Is someone there? In the trees, hiding, watching. More than one. He exhaled slowly. I sensed them, but I didn't know what they were. How long have they been there? Since we started out. They must have found us during the night. She brushed back loose strands of her honey-colored hair. I thought they were the spirits of the air at first, the ones from last night. But these are creatures of flesh and blood. She paused. They track us. Penn took her hand and squeezed it. His eyes swept the trees. Wait here. I'll tell Kermadec. But Kermadec already knew.
Urdas,
he advised, bending close to Penn to whisper the word.
Not many of them, but enough to keep us in sight without showing themselves. They're working in relays, small groups of them, each leapfrogging ahead of the others in turn to pick us up as we come past, bracketing us so that we don't get away.
Penn felt his heart quicken. What do they want? The Matarin glanced over. His bark-like features made him seem one with the trees.
They want to know what we are doing here. They will stay with us until they are sure.
Penn dropped back again, falling into step with Cinnaminson. He says he knows about them. He says they are just watching us. The rover girl smiled. Someone is watching them, too. Her blind eyes shifted to find his. The spirits of the air didn't leave after all. They are still out there. The morning passed away, and the clouds massed and darkened overhead. A storm was blowing in, and it would bring a heavy rain. Kermadec began to look for shelter, but there were no caves or rocky overhangs to keep them dry. Instead, they crawled beneath the protective boughs of a huge fir, hunkering down when the cloudburst struck, staying put until the rains had slowed to a drizzle, then crawling out again, dampened and chilled, to begin walking once more. That night, they camped in the lee of a lightning-split hardwood that had once risen hundreds of feet into the air and was now as dead as old cornstalks. Its leaves were gone, and its limbs blackened and bare, charred bones on a skeleton. All around its shattered trunk, the ground was burned and denuded as well, and their fire cast its broken giant's shadow into the enfolding darkness. Kermadec doubled the watch, and Penn hardly slept at all. Overhead, clouds scudded across the stars, and bats darted through the night like wraiths. The third day dawned gray and damp, but the rains did not return. The company set out at daybreak, the Urdas tracking it from somewhere in the trees where Penn still could not see them, even if Kermadec could. Penn was tired and irritable from a restless night, and he was unnerved by the constant, unseen presence. His spirits lifted only marginally when Kermadec assured him that they were getting closer to their destination. Seeing would be believing. By mid-morning, the look of the Incrim had undergone a noticeable change. The trees had become massive and twisted, a forest of ancient behemoths that crowded out everything smaller and left the valley floor barren and stark. The gray light filtering through the clouds was diffused further by the canopy of leaves and branches. The forest was shadowy and gray at every turn, and the air had grown thin and stale. Birdsong and insect buzzing disappeared, and the ground animals faded away. There was a hushed quality to the landscape that reminded the boy of places where only dead things were found. He heard the sound of his own breathing as he walked. He could hear the beating of his heart.
I don't like this place anymore, Cinnaminson whispered to him at one point, and took his hand in her own.
Sometime around midday, Penn saw the Urdas for the first time.
They appeared, all at once, coming out of the shadows, sliding from behind tree trunks, materializing out of nowhere. Even though he had never seen one before, he knew what they were immediately. They had a primitive, dangerous look to them. Physically, they appeared to be a cross between trolls and gnomes. Their bodies were small and wiry like those of the latter, but their skin was thick and bark-like, and their faces blunt and flat like the former. They were covered in a tangle of wiry hair, their trollish features flat and expressionless. Short, muscular legs and long arms allowed them to move sideways in crab fashion as they shadowed the company on both sides through the ancient trees.
"Stay together," Kermadec called back over his shoulder. "Don't provoke them. They're only watching."
But more were appearing at every turn, gathering at the fringes of the hazy light in large clusters. Gradually, they began to surround the company. For the first time, Penn noticed the nature of the weapons they carried, a mix of short spears and odd-shaped flat objects that were hooked and sharpened on their ends and appeared to be designed for throwing.
"How far do we have to go?"
Atalan called to his brother from his rearguard position. Kermadec glanced back and shook his head.
"I'm not sure. It's been a long time. Another few miles, maybe. This forest runs all the way to the ruins of the city. Keep moving."
Moments later, Mor Urdas appeared directly in front of them, narrowing the way forward even farther. They were beginning to close in, Penn realized. He did a quick count. More than 100 were set to block the way. The flat, dark faces were expressionless, but the way they hefted their weapons and the deliberate stances they had assumed suggested the nature of their intentions.
"Kyber Elysidil," Kermadec called out.
He beckoned her forward. The rest of the company closed in behind them, sensing that things were about to change.
"Can you work a little druid magic to make them move back?" the Matteran asked.
She frowned. "I can, but if I do that..."
"Yes. It may give us a way to the druids," he cut her short. "But if you don't, the Ur..."